Welcome to the AR Show, where I dive deep into augmented reality with a focus on the technology and uses of smart glasses and the people behind them. I'm your host, Jason McDowell. Today's conversation is with Qi Xu. She is the founder and CEO of Nreal, a company devoted to making consumer-facing mixed reality wearables available to all. After earning a PhD in electrical and computer engineering, she spent time at both NVIDIA and Magic Leap before leaving to join another startup. From there, he conceived and founded Nreal. Since its founding in 2017, Nreal has been aggressively iterating on their hardware and software and received a lot of press and awards, including Best Startup at CES and Best in Show at the Augmented World Expo. In this conversation, Qi talks about the origins of the company and how his team is outpacing the competition. We talk about Nreal's approach to making the glasses a complement to the smartphone and the path from wearable displays to fully featured AR smart glasses. He shares his perspective on alternative approaches to the market and the high barrier for any product to achieve.
A lot of people would do a surgery to get rid of the glasses, even they're very light. So unless you have very, very strong functionality or kind of excitement, or if it even look good. So customer is really hard to predict. I'm not an expert on that. We have to run the test. We have to pass a final test, which is the final consumer market, right? So we don't know yet.
We go on to talk about the copycat products we saw at this year's CES, as well as the lawsuit that Magic Leap has thrown his way. As a reminder, you can find the show notes for this and other episodes at our website, thearshow.com. That's thearshow.com. Let's dive in. Qi, what from your childhood set you up to be the sort of entrepreneur and innovator that you are today?
I'm a person who have very much general curiosity from the very beginning. I want to know what's going on with everything. So that's how probably I am when I was very young. And it's basically, you just want to know the answer. You want to know why is that, how you get there. And it kind of helps you throughout the time when you're growing up. And another thing is, you know, my life is not very kind of naturally moving. It's kind of ups and downs. There was like a one time there's a lot of changes in my life, and I just graduated my college, and I want to apply to the United States and study here. And usually it would take another year for me to really pass all the tests and apply a school there. So, but I started applying like August. I remember that very clearly because, you know, the school is supposed to start in a month. And I was applying actually for the next year. So I was emailing to a couple of professors that think it's a good fit. And instantly I got a reply saying, can you come back this year? And I was like shocked because usually you need a GRE test. You need a lot of other test score. And he said, okay, we can probably waive that. And then I got to the States like in less than 30 days. So things kind of changed rapidly after that. And actually, it turns out it's not a very good opportunity for me because, you know, he's a really tough professor and most of his students left his group. That's why he's desperate to find some new
fresh
students.
Blood.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I mean, ultimately, it's all turned out to be okay. And I learned that a lot. So I have to say life is always ups and downs and you have the kind of mentality to take that.
I found that one of the biggest challenges of being an entrepreneur, of being a CEO, is learning how to weather the emotional roller coaster.
Yep.
The highs are great, right? The fun to celebrate, the wins, but the lows can be really low.
I can totally get that. And even before the startup, actually, at some point, because, you know, my PhD study wasn't always very, very successful. So at some point, I was very, very down. It was like, you know, you're close to your 30. And you're kind of in danger of you finishing your PhD and you doubt everything of your life. And before that, everything was kind of like good. So you're like always a top student to your school and everybody thought you guys should be very successful and you should have been working like the top, you know, companies there. But it's turned out to the other way. But, you know, after all, you find a way to manage that and be tough and then really fight back. So, which is good. So I think in some way, maybe I'm prepared for this kind of, you know, mentality.
Yeah. And when was it for you? Were you this kind of vision for what Nreal could be? When did that start to percolate in your brain?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, it came down to a dinner I had with one of our, I would say another co-founder. He actually also is our seed investor. So he has been helping us throughout the way. So a little bit about our story. Actually, I didn't found this company right after I left Magic Leap. So I actually left Magic Leap for another smaller startup. I always want to do a startup at some point, but I don't think I'm ready. So I was saying, okay, why don't we see this as a front seat and learn a lot of things about it? So it is founded by some other Magic Leap employees, actually, ex-employees, and we're doing a lot of, you know, computer vision stuff. And my passion, it is until then I realized, okay, my passion is all about AR. And I don't want to like drifting away with that. So as one night, I was really, really unhappy and had a dinner with, you know, this PJ, which is our co-founder. So I was like kind of complaining and whining about everything in this company, like something I don't like. And he was saying, okay, everybody have a different taste. And, you know, running a company is the same thing. So if you don't like their taste, start your own. And I was like, will you help me if I do that? He said, why not? And it was kind of the moment, the defining moment. I think, okay, I finally have the courage to do this. Because, you know, this is my first startup. As a first-time entrepreneur, there's so many things you're afraid of, to be honest. And suddenly you feel like, okay, you have someone can back you up. And those people who have experience with, you know, different entrepreneurship, you know, different other stuff as well. And we actually, that night, we talked so much about what we think Unreal should be and what kind of product AR glasses there should be. And we learned a lot from, you know, existing products in the market. We think, you know, maybe they're trying too hard. Let's try a way that is, you know, we iterate over time, but let's get the first kind of version zero ready and appealing to most of the consumers.
So can you describe, and maybe this is all done in that one night when you had this amazing brainstorming session, but can you describe kind of where that endpoint is that you imagine and okay. what step zero looks like and why it makes sense for that path?
Always the end result will be everybody going to wear the glasses. It's going to be all day devices, like just like, you know, wearing normal glasses. When you wake up, you put this on, and even if it's not turned on, you will wear them all day. And there might be several voice assistant and help you to profile or prioritize all the information in the world and then fit you the right information at the right time. So I think, you know, that's the ultimate way. And you find a way, this is going to be a portal that really tap into the digital world and mix that perfectly with the reality. And everybody actually knows that. It's not a secret. I think everybody pretty much agreed on that's like the final kind of product.
That's our shared dream.
Exactly. And the problem is how we separate, because today we're all using smartphones. And everybody for the last probably 20 years, this is what people have been using. And how can we really migrate from today to that? Apparently different company and different people have different wills and they have to have different approaches, right? So we think as a smaller company, things will be complicated because you need to find profit. You need to find volume at each single step going there. And we do realize, okay, let's go in less ambitious at the very beginning. Try to create a product. It's not all-day devices, but it's all-day accessory. Meaning, okay, you want to carry this with you all the time, but you don't want to wear them all the time. But you have some killer use cases, you would willing to put this on and then plug this into your phone and then enjoy that. So it became a complement of what you're using today as a cell phone. And that if you think that way, things are getting a lot easier. Because, you know, if you look at all the existing previous products, what they're doing is, you know, they're trying to build something that replacing the phone. And to me, it feels like it's mission impossible because they're shooting the final target.
So phone complement is step zero.
I think so.
Yeah. So Microsoft has made arguably one of the most successful AR devices, and they are taking the opposite approach.
Right.
What's wrong with the Microsoft approach, or what's wrong with the Magic Leap approach, or some of the other approaches of the other folks that are out there?
I shouldn't say it's wrong because I don't know yet. Maybe we're wrong. I mean, we're not the judge to really say who is wrong or right. But I think, you know, different company will have different perspective. So just from our perspective, we think you need to define the right product. And it's not a dev kit. It's not the product they give to the developers. So we want to build something that really the regular customer, they can enjoy and they want to put on and they can enjoy on a daily basis. So if that's the case, so we're targeting more like a more mature product. what I can understand, say, if you look at, you know, HoloLens or Magic Leap or some other products at this moment, they said, okay, it's a dev kit. So it's more intended for, you know, either enterprise or either, you know, those developers. I think mainly because they think the technology isn't there yet. And I think, you know, at some point, it's not just them. Sometimes we're focusing too much on the technical detail and the technical component of the product. We forgot what's the requirement or the KPI at the system level and what's the really customer want to know. So that's the part I think, you know, we see a gap between what we're doing today to where we should be doing eventually. So we want to close that kind of gap. And in the meantime, I think, you know, different technology, different components will also evolve over time. But when we have there, not only we have the right components, we also have the right user interface, we have the right experience, we have the right, you know, other stuff to complement with the technology, with the component.
Yeah, that really is, I think, one of the key lessons that some of these more technology-oriented companies are slowly learning, is that there's a whole bunch of other things that are necessary to make it usable and desirable to be used. When you kind of look across the market, what is your perception of North Focals? And I bring them up because in some ways they have a similar perspective that the glasses are a complement to the phone. They're not trying to be the end-all, be-all of glasses. It's really meant to be an increment on glasses as opposed to, you know, three full 3D AR.
How exactly. Do you
make glasses smart?
Well, I think, you know, that's definitely a very approachable, very interesting solution or direction people would usually go. When they think, you know, that's kind of a, like an intermediate step to the final goal. And having still all day devices where you can wear all the time, but you have a limited functionality, right? I'm not sure. Just in my opinion, I think, you know, maybe there's not enough stickiness for people to use them. This is very interesting because, you know, a lot of people would do a surgery to get rid of the glasses, even they're very light. So unless you have very, very strong functionality or kind of excitement, or if it even look good. So customer is really hard to predict. I'm not an expert on that. We have to run the test. We have to pass a final test, which is the final consumer market, right? So we don't know yet. But just my opinion, I think maybe there's too limited in terms of functionality, just like Google Glass. So you won't probably see a massive adoption. And you don't see that kind of, you know, excitement coming out of the customer when they put this on.
Yeah. I love the comment about how people are willing to spend a lot of money to avoid wearing glasses. They're willing to spend a lot of money to go have surgery so they get that benefit of being able to see the world clearly without the need of having that extra device on their face. And so that hurdle for putting something back on your face is quite high.
It is quite high.
What do you think are those sorts of values that a consumer could get out of a first-gen product like the Nreal Lite you're planning to release later this year?
I find that surprising. Like some people would just say it looked good. You know, I will wear them. But I mean, to be honest, you know, we're still like a little bit bulkier at this moment. But something else will be, for example, you instantly have some massive, like immersive content or kind of experience with you. And say when you put on the, you know, VR headset, we know it's a lot heavier. It's a lot bulkier. And you look weird wearing them, but there's still a lot of people who wear them. And actually, we see a strong momentum coming out of the Quest, right? So that's the part I think, you know, if you really have some really immersive kind of experience and people would love, and also in the meantime, I mean, it doesn't look super weird in public and people would love to carry them with you, I think.
So describe an example immersive experience that would be highly motivational for people to want to put the glasses on.
Well, definitely. I would say, even as simple, say if you're a soccer fan, so you can watch the European Championship in a much, much bigger screen when you're riding a bus. And this is usually what you cannot do. You have to enjoy that on a smartphone, right? But in the meantime, you see ultra high definition and, you know, your home team is playing a derby game and this is a great timing. And you can watch them as if you're at home or even in the movie theater. As you go, I think, you know, a lot of people would love to pay some premium for that kind of experience.
So here we're talking about a portable big screen TV. Always got a big screen TV with you wherever you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not the natural like mixed reality experience to begin with, where people envision what's ultimately the kind of experience. But I think that's kind of experience will get people excited at the very beginning.
What else is on that list of the sorts of things that you imagine with this first generation that are going to really motivate people to go out and pick it up and use it ideally, right? Every day. You want this to be a device that's with them every day, giving value every day.
Exactly. I would say this. First, we create a display that is stunning good. I mean, people would love to watch like short videos, TV shows, movies, sports, and they would love to watch some content, even browsing with that. I think that's a good way to go. And in the meantime, you have a lot of very interesting and immersive 3D or mixed reality experience. Say you can play Angry Bird. You know, you can have like spatial type of experience. I think it's great. You can have multiple people collaborating together as if they're in the same room. So, and some of those kind of VR experience, even it's less impressive as VR, but it's still much more immersive than the other platform.
Yeah. And what are the kind of the key ingredients that are going into, maybe starting with the hardware, what are the key ingredients that are going into the hardware that enables Nreal to be what it is today, which is a pretty stylish, fairly light, and high quality visual experience device?
Well, I think it has to come down to the right product definition. That's the first thing. You have to know the technology, and you have to know the technology trend. What is possible, what is not possible in the near future, in today or in the near future, maybe in 5 to 10 years. And in the meantime, you have to understand, okay, what you want to deliver. As we mentioned, we're not building all the devices. Instead, we're building all the accessory that people would like to carry around with you, put in your purse. That's the way you can really put them on anytime you want. And in the meantime, once you have that, then we can talk about, say, okay, how light it can be, right? And how small it can be. And how good they can be looking and all those kind of stuff. I think we're lucky we find a team that have the kind of skill set to do all of those.
Yeah, we actually just saw each other a few days back at this conference in San Francisco, Photonics West. And there, the focus is really on the display systems and the optic systems that enable kind of the photon generation and modulation and redirection to make for really compelling experiences. What are you doing uniquely in that regard?
Well, so first of all, you have to keep up with, you know, the latest in the industry. And in the meantime, you have to think about, okay, there's anything that fits your strength. So that's why we actually, when we want to do this, we actually start talking to so many people from the industry about, okay, what we can do and what kind of display. I think, you know, in my opinion, it's very important. And even you're talking about display, there's a different spec about the display, right? You have the resolution, you have the weight, you have the kind of form factor, you have the look, everything, right? So it just, you know, different people will have a different function to define what is a good display. And we clearly think, you know, having a really lightweight and really low cost, but stunning, like great resolution, great contrast, color is very important. So that's why it comes down to, if you figure out what is the priority of your different specs, finding the right, you know, path, it should be more straightforward. And we just had a great team, you know, execute that and kind of really exceed our expectation about, you know, what we can achieve. And that's why we build a factory. That's why we think really we're going to have heavy investment on this kind of stuff. And it helps the supply chain, everything in the following as well.
Within that set of components that goes into glasses, what is it that your team specifically is innovating on and doing separate from maybe a supplier? Because here you're using a Sony micro OLED panel.
Right.
And you're integrating that with some optics that are not the waveguide optics that some people are talking about.
No.
It's an alternative design. It's a birdbath sort of optics.
Yeah.
Where is the Nreal magic being added within that part of
the product? Let's say birdbath is very straightforward. It's very simple, right? So we take a step further. We made a lot of innovation on top of the birdbath and making sure that, okay, in terms of the form factor, the resolution, the contrast, and the efficiency, actually most important efficiency, is going to be a lot better than the regular birdbath.
Hmm.
So that's why we think, you know, we have actually a lot of IP surrounding that. And we had even more know-how and knowledge about how to really mass produce them. So we start doing this for the mass production, actually starting May 2018, actually. And we built a very small lab and fab into our company.
Hmm.
So we have a clean room there, even like 2.5 years ago. So, and like last year, we moved everything into the factory. So it's like all clean roomed, it's more automated. And then we have a lot of customized tool set that can complement that. And nowadays we start to bring up the yield. Everything is more, so the alignment, everything, you know, no one has done this before. So this is very interesting. I mean, even this is, looks very easy and fundamental. No one really done this before, making sure you can mass produce them in a high quality and bring the cost down. And I think, you know, that's also the benefit being in China, is you have a lot of, you know, experienced people that can help you to bring this into the next level.
Yeah. That was actually something I was curious about. So you'd, after spending all these years in the US, you chose to start this company back in China. Was that the primary motivating factor?
Well, I would say this. We still consider ourselves like more international company. And we think, you know, as time goes by, as we growing, and think you're going to see more and more presence in the US, in else the world. The reason we actually pick our first location in China is we think this is the beginning of a new decade. And usually the hardware will be the key differentiator at the very beginning. And closer to the supply chain actually going to bring a lot of advantage, being faster iteration and bring down the cost a little bit more. So if you look at even not from the AR perspective, even from the drone industry, you realize, okay, closer to the supply chain, having a lot of the advantage, especially at the very beginning, you need a, so we haven't really figured out what is the golden kind of product definition of a drone. And then different people will race to that kind of competition. And then if you're closer to the supply chain, you have a lot of advantage. And also, if you look back, see, there's a lot of AR company kind of failed in, you know, in their early days, like Meta, like ODG, they also suffer like kind of slow iteration. And they suffer a lot of issues with mass production as well. So that's why we think, you know, at the very beginning, that can be the biggest hurdle for any company, especially startups. So that's why we picked China to get started.
Yeah, that's really thoughtful. As I engage with startups, this is one of those things that I also look for, is how effectively are they iterating?
Right.
How are they learning, incorporating those learnings into the next iteration?
Yep.
Because often those that can most effectively iterate and learn the fastest are the ones that ultimately are able to achieve that sort of product market fit and give themselves a chance of great success. What is it, as you've been kind of working that close to the rest of the supply chain with kind of the perspective, the mindset that you've got, what are some of the key learnings that you've had along the way that you keep incorporating into the next iteration of the product?
You know, always test the market with a real customer. I think it's important because, you know, usually what I, or most of the people usually make the mistake, like thinking this is the right demands for the customer. This is the right features for the right customer, and they should appreciate that. Unless you're a genius like Jobs, right? Otherwise, I think, you know, the best way to really test them is to let the real customer try that and give you the real feedback. So that's why we're doing. I think, you know, this is such a new product and people are so used to the smartphone. I mean, this is, smartphone is so successful that kind of overtaking, like imagine how many times you consume your cell phone. You're going to realize, okay, how successful that is. So having another one that can replace that really has a long way to go. So that's why we think, you know, it has to take steps to get there. And you have to, for each single step, you have to making sure that, okay, the customer will willing to migrate slowly from smartphone to that. So we've been running so many tests with different customers and realize, okay, different, even customer from different country have slightly different behavior. So you have to making sure that, you know, in my opinion, say, because we're still a startup, so how can you find the right partner that can do this with you? It's also critical. That's why we reach out to different telcos. We think, you know, those are probably the best partner and distribution partner with us to begin with. So we can actually learn from their own country, from their own customer behaviors.
Yeah. So there you're really stressing the fact that you're a complement, an accessory to the phone.
That's right.
In that regard. And so as you've been doing this sort of testing and picking up some of these learnings about the nuances in the user behavior, how has that informed the product? Have there been some surprising learnings that took you in a slightly different direction than maybe you were pointing at initially?
That's right. Honestly, like say, for example, initially, what we want is build SDK and build a great, you know, developer community so they can enable a lot of 3D contents on top of the glasses. Like, you know, what the other company has been doing, like, you know, Microsoft or Magic Leap or all the others. Then we realized, okay, it's a chicken egg problem. it's hard to really convince them to develop content if you don't have a volume. It's going to be hard. And even, say, take Microsoft, for example. I mean, they're such a massive company, but still, you don't see a lot of content on their platform. And those contents, they're great, but they're not good enough to have all the people using them on a daily basis. So then they got you thinking, okay, maybe that's not the only approach. Can you really leverage what they're having already? Like, you know, the mobile contents, the mobile phone contents. So that's why it got us thinking, any chance we can really find a way to not only support all the 3D or the mixed reality applications, but also all the 2D applications. And that's also where our product can shine, because we have a great display. We have a very intuitive and easy to use kind of interface. So I think that really kind of filled the gap and a lot of doubts for the people from the industry, because, you know, usually people would think, where is the content? Especially, you know, for a smaller company, how can you convince the other people that you will have contents and you will be willing to build contents for them? And once you have people say, okay, if you can leverage all the existing contents and make them bigger and in higher res, I think, you know, some customer, I'm not saying all of them, but some of the customer will get excited. They probably will use them on a daily basis. And once you really reach, like, say, 1 million units use base, and then it's a lot easier for you to talk to the other people. And also, I think, you know, another creative, a critical point is, you know, you have a really affordable price point. So in that case, then the developer will say, okay, this is a lot better than, you know, a $2,000 kind of a headset, right? It's probably too pricey for most of the real customer to use that. But $499, I think it's a good starting point. So they actually will willing to try that a lot earlier than the other devices.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, it's a really interesting strategy to leverage all the existing 2D content. Kind of this notion, it's a second screen, a portable screen that's with you all the time, because every streaming service, every YouTube video is content that works well on your platform.
Yep.
You kind of noted that some of the other things that you're doing is on the novelty on the user experience side.
Yeah.
You talk a little bit about what you've done that's unique and how users interact with the content that they can see in the glasses.
Yeah. Well, let's say this. So customers is, you know, you don't want to make a sophisticated kind of interface. You don't want to do a brand new interface. It's hard because, you know, you still remember like how we teach like some senior people how to use a smartphone. Like, it takes longer than we expected, actually, for the people to really adopt to a new platform and new user interface, all the new experiences. So that's why we think when you build something, you got to be making sure this is, you know, very intuitive, very easy to use, and very easy to understand for existing customers. How do you do that? You know, they're familiar with the cell phone. They're familiar with those the whole touch screen, the mechanism like that. So can we really turn the phone into the controller? And making sure, okay, you're doing something very similar to, you know, the phone which you're familiar with. And in that case, I think it's a good starting point. And then you start migrate, slowly migrate and testing different kind of stuff that you can really try something different. Say maybe add gestures and maybe add voice recognitions that you can control in a different way. And in that case, you know, people would realize, okay, maybe it's better to do the voice recognition and start to slowly migrate from what they're familiar with, which is a cell phone, to the new platform. And maybe give that a couple of years when people start to really understand what the glasses interaction is, then, you know, I think this kind of whole migration process would be done.
Yeah. I think it's kind of harkens back a bit to the smartphone evolution as well. Right there, we kind of took a similar approach, thinking specifically about Microsoft and Windows Mobile and Windows CE back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, they basically tried to take a desktop experience and cram it into the phone in recreating the mouse using the stylus and the same sort of app model. And there was an evolution. BlackBerry kind of took a more optimized approach to what that experience should look like. And they had the scroll wheel on the side and kind of the basic push button. And then Apple, of course, took a major step forward.
Exactly.
Aided by kind of a capacitive touchscreen that was a lot better touch experience than what came before. And,
yep.
And making what seemed at the time like an absurd trade-off, where they completely threw away the keyboard altogether and required you to interact with it exclusively through the touchscreen.
That's right.
But it opened up a lot more other opportunities for them to create and innovate on the user experience side. Yeah. And so you anticipate a similar sort of evolution where we're able to borrow a lot from the current behaviors around mobile phones and use that as a stepping stone to create these more novel and unique experiences that make sense within the smart glass realm.
I think, you know, for any major paradigm shifting, it's a must. because otherwise, you know, you're not going to, you know, have a cold start. And we actually learned that from iPad migration. So when you first realize, okay, when iPad came out, there's no dedicated content for iPad only. Probably the only thing they have is iBook, right? But what they did a smart thing about it is they support all the iPhone applications out of the box and just make that bigger. Even, I'm not sure if you remember, the aspect ratio is actually wrong.
Yeah, it's different. It's wider.
It's different. It's wider. But mm-hmm. in the meantime, you know, you have the browser and you have a lot of iPhone applications to begin with. And instantly, all those content providers realize, okay, we have to build a HD, high-definition version of the application for iPad, because otherwise, you know, your competitor will take advantage of that opportunity. And, you know, as time goes by, you see a lot of dedicated application only for iPad, right? And later on, once you have high volume, a lot of developers can build something only for iPad.
Yeah, it's a great parallel, right? Because there it was, iPad's a big screen, it's a good content viewing, streaming experience. Yeah. It's got the browser. And I remember those giant, they almost look like the ridiculous TV shows where they have this, you know, oversized chair and the human being, a normal sized human being sits in chair, just looks ridiculous, look like a small child. Anyway, that's kind of like those, what the iPhone apps would look like on the iPad. They looked ridiculously large.
I know.
As you kind of blew up.
And I still remember like at the very beginning, because I was in the US back, you know, when iPad was introduced, and a lot of people kind of have doubts about this product. Like, okay, we have iPhone, we have phone already, we have the laptop already. Why do we need someone in the middle? Right? And it turns out a lot of people actually have the needs.
Yeah, absolutely. So today, the glasses are a complement to the phone.
Right.
What does that look like 5 years from now? What is the relationship between the device that you're going to create in 5 years and the phone of that time?
Well, I think, you know, phone is a terminal, a platform that has the display, the interaction, and the compute. I think, you know, with 5G coming to the play, there might be, phone is probably the last product, has all the functionality into the same thing. So glasses definitely have a great way to display and interact and collect information. And maybe with 5G, with help of 5G, you can offload a lot of compute and rendering and all the other stuff onto the cloud. That means, okay, maybe there's less and less kind of need about the cell phone itself. So maybe I can see, maybe it's not in 5 years, but say, let's give that 5 to 10 years. At some point, we might be completely missing the cell phone in our lives. I think, you know, I can totally see that coming in my lifetime. So it's going to be excited. And maybe there's someone between is you have a watch that has some kind of compute resources and they have the glasses and they can talk to each other. And then you have the 5G module that can really talk to the server next to you.
I like that vision. I believe that there is this, or agree, I guess, with this idea that there's likely going to be another complementary device to the glasses, even if the phone itself gets smaller and smaller until it completely wraps around your wrist with the same set of power. But there are some benefits to having an opaque screen that's in your pocket around, carrying around all the time for certain types of experiences. And I think we're going to hold on to that for quite some time.
That's right. And also, I mean, exactly, that's what people have been using for the last 20 years. But let's think about maybe younger generation, say, give that, say, maybe your grandchildren. They'll be surprised to see, hey, why you guys still have like a box in your pocket when you want to access data from the internet? Just like, you know, when we think about, okay, maybe two generations ahead, is like, we still use like telegrams, like all the other stuff, right? We cannot understand today.
Yeah, very
true. That's how technology evolves, I guess.
Yeah. Do you have any kind of perspective on 5G as a radio technology?
Yep.
That's relatively high power, mm-hmm. has its own quirks to it.
Definitely.
Sitting next to the brain.
We had some talks with, you know, different kind of folks in this about this. I think it's possible. It's definitely not possible in the near future, but it's definitely possible. Mm. And first of all, I think radiation is not an issue eventually, because the kind of eventually would just feel like heat. So it's going to not hurt your brain for sure. And there shouldn't be any kind of health issues, but it has to be going through a lot of tests to finally get there. But I think we're very promising. We think, you know, it's going to be there. So eventually you have a glasses that is very efficient, and you have the 5G module also very efficient, you know, fit into that.
Yeah. So this is kind of the progression. Certainly 5G chips are first going to go in our phones.
Right.
And they'll aid in the way that you described, which is you can offload some of these compute tasks to the cloud or the near edge
yep.
of the cloud. And that will certainly benefit a device that is ultimately, you're carrying the screen around your face that has all these extra pixels, and every one of those pixels needs to be calculated many times a second. And there's a lot of work that goes into that. And so as we imagine an all-day wearable thing, some of that wearability, or the all-day, I guess, side of that, the battery power gets consumed by the compute. And so 5G has potential benefit there. So as you kind of imagine these early use cases as you for the consumer, which is the second screen, is kind of the toehold, while also enabling from a UX perspective, from a SDK perspective, from a set of sensors on the device perspective, more immersive 3D AR experiences as well.
Yep.
Where does the enterprise opportunity fit in for you?
Okay. So even when we launched Unreal Light, we've been gathering from a lot of inquiries about, you know, different enterprise users. They actually liked us. And enterprise is actually easier, in my opinion. It's just they have a very straightforward kind of functionality. And what they're targeted as, you know, can we make this more productive or even safer, right? And help their kind of working process and make that even better. And they can tolerate all the other stuff if we can make meet their goals. So the only thing is we have to be careful is, you know, for a lot of use cases in the vertical, there's a lot of certifications and safety kind of requirements. And that's not what our current generation is targeted at. But we're hardware, we made hardwares, right? So building different kind of hardwares, it should be easy for us. And we fully anticipate to see some new things that is really dedicated to enterprise later this year from Unreal.
What are the specific use cases? Because there are a handful of use cases that have kind of cropped up in the enterprise today that smart glasses seem to make a lot of sense for, whether it's guided instruction or remote expertise or that sort of thing, right? Are those the same ones that you think apply to Unreal, or is there something different or unique about Unreal that makes for a different sort of primary use case?
Well, so apparently, you know, we're kind of, in terms of the functionality, we're not as rich as HoloLens, right? So HoloLens is a great, great enterprise product. And there's also, you know, if you're looking for really lightweight, you can see North and Google Glass play a role into that as well. But I think, you know, for enterprise, different kind of use cases have different requirements. I really see a big chunk of that will fit into what Unreal Light can bring with. You know, it has a lot of rich kind of functionalities, but also lightweight compared to the others. And also it's more affordable. And whether it's tethered or not tethered, so there should be plenty of the use cases. And when we talk to them, we're thinking is, you know, for a smaller company, you know, what is the best way to really scale the use cases? And that's how we really prioritize our kind of use cases when we go to the vertical. We talk to all the people and we figure out what is the most fast growing kind of industry that we should enter first.
Yeah. You've raised so far $30 million.
Right.
That's been publicly announced anyway.
Yep.
To bring this concept to market.
Right.
North Focals, by comparison, has raised over the course of the company, because they had a previous life before the focus on the eyewear. They had the armband concept previously. But throughout the course of the company, they've raised $200 million.
That's right.
Do you anticipate needing to raise significantly more money as you bring this product to market? To really get it out there?
We definitely need more money to bring this to into market, right? And but we try to, you know, still stay smaller. And when we go to market, and we try to take, you know, smaller steps to verify each single, you know, kind of decision we're making that is really the right one. So that's kind of our strategy, making sure as when you're young, when you're smaller, making sure you're making the right decision and make the most efficient decision as well. So that's why you say, we don't plan to have like a lot of retail store of our own. And we don't, we want to work with some right partners that want to scale this with us. You know, take telco, for example. I think, you know, it's a great, great collaboration opportunity for both of us, say with the 5G commercialization coming to each countries. They also want to find some good products and new products that can really showcase the 5G. And I think, you know, as a great complement to the cell phone and, you know, tether to the cell phone and leverage all the 5G module out of that, I think we made a strong case for that. And instantly in this way, I think, you know, go to market is going to be a lot of, you know, more affordable, I guess, and more efficient for us. So that's kind of our strategy.
Yeah. You don't have some very elaborate fitting experience that was required you to go to a very specialized sort of location in order to get the glasses. This, anybody can walk into any, for example, any sort of telco store,
yep,
and pick up a pair of Enreal as they're updating their phone or getting a new phone there.
Yep.
Yeah. I was at CES. One of the things that I was surprised by wasn't just simply that you have a competitor in North who is going after a somewhat similar approach to the market, even though the kind of their initial use cases might be a little bit different. But there were a number of knockoffs who clearly were very excited about what you're doing and paying you the utmost, highest compliment by imitating the product itself. How is it that you deal with those? Does that concern you that these knockoffs are there?
So first of all, I think, you know, you have to accept that, you know, when you're doing something, if you think it's right or some other people think it's right, they will try to copy you and they'll do even more. So that's just the nature of the business. And all you can do is, you know, keep innovating. I want to say, actually, we really value innovation a lot. And we think we're innovating and we're building something that is not seen by the others. And we value that and we'll keep doing this. So hopefully you think, you know, when they see the other knockoffs, they're going to realize, okay, it's still far off. And the reason it's still far off is, you know, we've been investing so heavily in those key components ourselves and making sure they're unique and they're the best in the market. So when you're looking at this whole product, we think, you know, you have the supply chain, you have the product itself and the technology with it, and you have the distribution and ecosystem, right? So maybe for the first 2 years, we're targeting at is the product itself and some key technologies and then the supply chain. So we actually spend a lot of time and resources making sure that we can have this capability to mass produce them. And actually, in the right now, we're building our second factory, making sure we have a lot of capacity by the end of this year. So that's kind of the advantage we're having as a, you know, in terms of like a long run. And in the meantime, you know, since last year we debuted at CES, we actually start talking to different distribution channels. We actually start to build our ecosystems. All those kind of stuff will take effort and time. And I think, you know, in some way, we get some recognition from the industry, from the community. So make us the best solution or one of the best solution in the market when they go to. So those are kind of stuff we think, you know, it's hard to copy. And also, you know, you got to keep innovating. This is still the beginning of a new decade, right? So you got to have some kind of confidence about, you know, if you can do this for the last 3 years, give us another 5 years, I think, you know, there's a good chance we can keep surprising the industry and the people.
Yeah, I like that. I hold the firm belief that the way to stay ahead, the way to truly sustain a competitive advantage is through two methods. One of them is continuous innovation, and the other is a very complementary side of that, which is a fantastic company culture. When you combine those two things together, you have a chance to really maintain that competitive advantage. Yeah. So besides those knockoffs, and I have to agree that I went and checked them out, and with my own eyes, they were very poor copies of the product you've created in Rio. But there's also that other looming company that's been out there causing a bit of a headache, which is Magic Leap. So independent of their product and how that might directly compete in the market, they've been creating a bit of headache by creating this lawsuit for you. How is it that that affects your plans going forward?
Well, I have to say this. I think, you know, having a lawsuit, especially a bad lawsuit, to stop innovation is really bad for the whole community. And I hope, you know, whoever does that will realize that. And all we're trying to, I think, you know, that's also their purpose. They try to slow us down because we have a such more affordable and you're ready to the market product. And all we can do is try our best to not get slowed down by this kind of behavior. I think luckily, most of the people, they recognize that. And all the international partners, they still working with us and they actually come to us after this. And that kind of shows some confidence about our products and our company and the culture, as you mentioned. I hope this can pass away very quick, but we prepared it for everything.
Got it. It doesn't really concern you outside of the headache that maybe it causes.
I think, you know, when you're successful, you know, your competitors going to try everything to slow you down. And just that's just the nature. And if you easily get slowed down by them, that's your fault. And I also want to say, you know, their failure, I'm not the reason of their failure. And if they fail in the end, they need to look at, okay, why they failed this? Why they, I think it's the only reason for failure of a company will be fail to deliver a product that market needs. So let's all focus on our own business and try to make a great product. This is still the very beginning, and there's still a huge market. So yeah, I think, you know, that's what we should focus on right now.
Yeah. So Magic Leap isn't keeping you up at night. These Chinese knockoff companies, the other guys out there trying to make something similar to what you're doing, they aren't keeping you up at night. Who or what in this industry does make you the most nervous?
Well, I would say probably there's a lot of major company that haven't really joined the party yet, right? So ultimately, this is, you know, a really platform play. And there's going to be a lot of big players jumping into this party. And those are actually the parts we're a little bit nervous. But, you know, as a startup, you're always nervous. There's so many things to worry about. But you have to be always confident about, you know, what you believe in. So I like what we're doing for the last, you know, several years. And I think, you know, people start to realize, okay, Unreal is a slightly different company and definitely a quite different company as a, you know, a Chinese company. So as time goes by, I think, you know, we definitely will have more and more people joining us and joining, sharing the same kind of vision. And we're hoping, nervous is, I probably won't say nervous. I would say, I think it's a good thing to have all the right people joining the party, because ultimately that's how you make the industry better. If you look at the smartphone, you know, all the great companies are doing this and making this better, not only from the hardware perspective, but also software and interface and everything, right? So that's ultimately we have the smartphone as we're today. So you're not stopping that. You should endorse that and embrace the innovation and competition. So we'll say we welcome that. And we have to be aware, say, at the end of the day, if you couldn't keep up this kind of competition, you'll fall behind. But that's just the nature of business.
Indeed. So as you kind of look at your own journey as an entrepreneur,
yep,
as you noted, this is your first go around.
Yep.
In the startup experience. How have you grown since starting this company?
Wow. That's a lot. I mean, I have to say, because me, myself, I came from a technical background, you know, so my PhD is actually about CPU and GPU architecture. So I came from like a hardware or system level knowledge, and then I slowly migrate to software. So the benefit of those is like you usually try to have some sort of high level understanding about everything. And then you have to jump into a completely new era, you know, business and management, everything else, right? So surprisingly, when I was at Magic Leap, but even before, I never really managed any team. So I'm only like a software engineer. And now you have to run a bigger company, and every aspect of that, it is challenging, and you have to keep up with that kind of you cannot stop the car and then start learning. You have to learn while you're driving. Mm. So it is challenging, but I think it's also very, very exciting. And I'm lucky we have the right people, you know, surrounding us and help us to go through this journey together.
Mm. What have been some of the most challenging growing pains as you've gone from being that software engineer who's maybe more of an individual contributor to having a large team of people that ultimately report to you and 1,000 different questions to answer and decisions to make every day?
Well, I would say, I still remember like at the very beginning, recruiting is very hard. Because when you have no product and you just have a vision, and even getting money or getting the right people is going to be extremely hard. Because, you know, you have to convince them in some way, and you don't have anything to show that or prove that. So luckily, we show our true selves, we share our vision, and we probably make a very compelling case that, you know, a lot of really great talent people join us. And that's how we can really get started. And later on, when the company goes bigger and bigger, so we're still trying to build like a very Silicon Valley type kind of startup in China, which is kind of rare. So we try to make this very flat. And the very beginning, it's like most of the people report to you. And as time goes by, you have a lot of travels. Mm-hmm. And you cannot keep up with, you know, all the reportings. You have to try to manage, cut that and manage in a different way. Those kind of part is challenging. And this is definitely growing pains to get there. And still, we're kind of in the phase of, you know, having more people rising up help me to manage the company in their own, you know, area. And also we start recruiting even more experienced people helping us in different aspects.
Yeah. Still having fun with it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Let's wrap up with a few enlightening round questions here.
Sure.
What commonly held belief about spatial computing do you disagree with?
I would say probably the most part is we shouldn't just shoot for the ultimate solution. at the very beginning. We should go like, just what we're doing right now is like take a step at a time and then evolve over time. Because, you know, the migration is so hard. I understand all the beautiful things, you know, ultimately going to be there. But in the meantime, you have to convince the customer, convince the market, convince the industry that you're making the right move. And the only way to do that is you really get the positive feedback from the real customers. And everything going to eventually be there. And, you know, as a company, you have to make sure that you will be there as the time was there. So that's the part I would say, probably a lot of people are focusing too much on the technical, you know, aspect or component there, but they forget about, you know, what is needed at system level and who is defining kind of the system level requirement. It is the real customer. Just that's my feeling.
Yeah. Fundamentally.
Yep.
The user knows best.
Yep.
Based on their behavior. We'll know. Besides the one you're building, what tool or service do you wish existed in the AR market?
Well, there's so many. Like say, we wish, you know, there's like more automated content creation kind of tool, making sure there's more and more, you know, holograms and 3D contents that can go with that. And it's, you know, in the meantime, you probably need a lot more, you know, developer community that can go with that. But you also understand that this is also a chicken and egg problem, right? So hardware is always the foundation of a new paradigm. Once you have hardware, you have developers, you have the ecosystem, you have the software, you have all the other stuff with it. But, you know, also as an infrastructure, I think, you know, we're going from internet, the mobile internet, and now we're saying, we think it's more like spatial internet. And the reason we're saying this is, you know, we're digitalizing the entire reality into a digital world and all those kind of information with it. And we want to kind of match or mix those kind of information perfectly with the real reality. And those kind of stuff will require a lot of fundamental work to do, you know, from the cloud service perspective, from the scanning perspective. When we're talking about map, probably in 5 to 10 years, we're talking about not just Google Maps. We're talking about probably a map about the entire reality of the world. And when we see a table, you probably see the table as the material, the price, and everything. And I see a table, if it's in the restaurant, it's maybe the menu. So those kind of information, we don't have them yet. Mm-hmm. We're hoping those kind of infrastructure will be ready when the glasses is more popular.
Mm. That's good. What book have you read recently that you found to be deeply insightful or profound?
Okay, so I have to say, I probably should have read a book a long time ago. This is by Andy Grove, The High Output Management. Hmm. As we're talking, we're going through like growing pains about how to manage a company as they get scaling up. And running a company when there are 50 people and with 150 is completely different. So I really learned a lot. And I think, you know, the kind of what we learn from the past is always try to work with the best. You know, we're even today, we're trying to making sure not only we work the best engineers and scientists, you know, from the industry, and also talk to the best company in the ecosystem, in the industry, making sure, you know, you can keep up with their knowledge, their vision, their innovation as well.
Hmm. If you could sit down and have coffee with your 25-year-old self, what advice would you share with 25-year-old Qi?
So when I was 25, I probably in the downtime, struggling in my PhD, in my graduate school, and I'm lucky it all turned out be okay. So I would probably say to myself is, trust yourself and be calm, and your time will rise up.
Hmm. Patience.
Yep.
Trust yourself. Awesome. Any closing thoughts you'd like to share?
I think, you know, this is a great time. I think, you know, we're in a great, great industry. So I probably shouldn't say this, but when I joined NVIDIA, I was all excited. This is my first job after grad school, and all my PhD work is about GPU architecture. And then I realized, okay, it is less kind of growing industry because, you know, there's a lack of competition. You don't see a lot of other company making GPUs, right? And kind of innovation will slow down a little bit. So that's the nature of the competition in the business. And then if that's the case, you don't really see a great opportunity for your career for the maybe next to 10 to 20 years. So that's why I kind of switch and try to migrate and, you know, picking something else. And I have to say, AR and XR is probably the most exciting industry for the next 10 years. And I'm lucky we had a role in this industry today, and we're hoping for the next 5 to 10 years, we can keep, you know, innovating people and working with the great people in this industry and make the life better for everyone.
Yeah, that's awesome. If you could place where we are right now in this industry on a timeline, and maybe match that timeline to either the smartphone timeline or the mobile phone timeline or the PC timeline, where do you think we kind of fit?
Well, that's hard. Definitely different people will have different thoughts about it. I will say this. I think, you know, the supply chain wasn't there yet, at least for the key components, and the product definition is not converged yet. And definitely we don't have ecosystem, we don't have the developer, those kind of stuff. So I would say it's definitely maybe 3 years before iPhone 0, if you're talking about smartphones. But I think, you know, the next 3 years is going to be very, very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we're hoping, you know, in 3 years, we can be, you know, people going to still enjoy Unreal and eventually at some point say, it's like today when you're talking about smartphone, you think of iPhone, you think about, you know, Samsung Galaxy. We're hoping, you know, when the time is there, when they think about AR glasses, Unreal is one of the name in their mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Qi, thanks so much for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Before you go, I'm going to tell you about the next episode. In it, I speak with Casper Tikier. Casper is the co-founder and CEO of Zappar, an AR platform and creative studio on a mission to democratize AR and MR. Casper and the Zappar team have been vanguards in the AR industry for the last decade. Prior to founding Zappar, Casper spent 15 years as an account director and managing director of major advertising agencies, including one where he was a founding partner. In this conversation, we talk about the role Zappar has played in the evolution of the industry, as well as some of the experiences they've created for the world's biggest brands. He describes how they're turning static products and packaging into media channels, as well as his 5 C's for AR success. I think you'll really enjoy the conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss this or other great episodes. Until next time.